May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be free from harm. May all beings love life. May all beings awaken. Welcome to another episode of Life in Bali. I'm DC Puba of Cuke Audio and Cuke Archives, coming to you from Sleepy Sanur with Doggett Bandita, Feline Kuchita, and dear lovely Katrinka. And Life in Bali, as many of you know, is our Thursday vacation from all that silly Zen stuff. Now, I pray that you and yours are safe and comfortable and free of economic distress and hardship and able to get out and do whatever you want within the limitations of the universal precept of do as little harm as possible. Now, today's guest is Hira Jamtani, and she's an environmentalist, and she and her husband, Deepak, are friends of ours, and they own a natural food store that we love to go to. And she's got a pretty interesting story here, pretty interesting history. And she's got a really cool website. It's called Bebas Pikir. Bebas is free, Pikir is think. So it's, in English under it, it's Free Thoughts of Hira Jamtani. Now, there's, it's full of English. There's English and Indonesian. You know, it's like, here, let's see. Here's something she wrote. Matru Pitru Vandanam, the divinity of parents. As you will learn, Hira and her husband Deepak are Hindus, but not in the Bali tradition. Their ancestry is Pakistani Hindu, and the Pakistani Hindus, had to leave at partition. A lot of them, many of them, a number of them ended up here. And she writes here, that this is just the introduction to a piece she wrote on the website you can read. It says, Matru Pitru Vandanam celebrates the divinity of mother and father, and therefore the divinity of human beings. I feel it's a concept of finding divinity from within by respecting the divinity of parents. Ah, well, that's a nice thought. And then she's got the disaster of the Blue Revolution about shrimp farming, cooking from kitchen waste, which you will hear about. And here's another one. TV gadget. Look at this. TV gadget dinner and industrial capitalism. So there's a few things that are featured there. It's got articles. Oh, a number of them. Articles on nature and life. And then she has books and films, journeys and people, home cooking and eating food and ecological agriculture. Anyway, check out Bebas Pikir. That's Bebas Pikir.com. And that'll get you there. And you see a picture of her up front, and she's way up high somewhere overlooking a valley. I don't know where that is. It might say down below. It says, welcome to Bebas Pikir, a website on free thinking. Bebas Pikir is an Indonesian term which means thinking freely. Hira Jamtani, that is me. The creator of this web is a free, independent, ordinary person who likes to observe life. Writing is my passion. Since I was young, I enjoy many aspects of life, such as traveling and knowing about new places, especially natural ones, reading, watching films, gardening, conducting transformation, facilitation, cooking and eating healthy food, and of course, I love to sleep. I am also a translator and interpreter. Yeah, wow, cool. Hira and I have both attended retreats of Murta Atta, who's a Buddhist here who has secular retreats. He's like a Buddhist healer, but all he does is help people heal themselves. And he studied with the great Vipassana teacher here, Bhante Giri Murta Atta. But his retreats are secular and have Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists and Christians and Jews and atheists. Anybody who wants to come, he does them in English and Indonesian. So this is the second phone chat I've had with Hira. Hira and I talked for a good long time yesterday, and there was a technical problem, and I lost the audio. The first one I've lost. And so she very graciously agreed, without hesitating, to do it again today. And so we did. And that was really great. And then the weirdest thing happened. Oh, I was just horrified. I thought I'd lost it too. I mean, it's like lightning striking twice. It took me a while, and almost by accident, I discovered I hadn't lost it. Because, see, I record the, this was done on Messenger, Facebook Messenger, and I record it with a program called CallNote, and that makes an MP3. And then I put that into my editing program, Audacity. But when it went down on Audacity, it was mostly just blank. God. And then I got a message that my computer was too full. And then, so, you know, I was freaking out. I was just really, I was shocked. I was mortified. I thought, oh God, I can't, oh, I have to call her and tell her. Will she do it again? I bet she will. But I have some of it there. Let's see what I have and this and that. And then I looked and see, well, how could it be full? And then, you know, when I realized I just erased a whole lot of, deleted a whole lot of stuff because it had gotten really full. But I forgot to empty my recycle bin. And listen, I've been doing so much recording, mainly with the podcast, but I do music recording too. And I had all these audio files that I had deleted that were just in trash, just one after another. And then some of them are WAV files, which are much bigger, MP3s, Audacity files. And I emptied my wastebasket. You know how much that freed up? 375 gigabytes. But that's on my Drive D. Now my Drive C, which has programs and stuff, is pretty full too, so I'm going to work with my tech guy on that because he can come in remotely and he can take stuff out and we'll agree on what I need and what I don't need. So anyway, oh God, was I relieved. You know how I discovered, I almost gave up, but then I thought, well, let me look at the file it comes from. And it was all there. Oh, God, was I relieved. And then I realized, oh, there was enough memory for it to record, but not for it to go down on Audacity. And I thought, wow, did I cut that one close? Anyway, Thank you very much for doing it twice here. So here we go. Let's give her a call, okay?
Hello, David.
Hello, Hira. Yeah, this is audio only, no camera.
Okay, so I don't have to dress up proper, that's the thing.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
Oh, you know, one thing about having to go over all that again is I enjoy talking with you. So I'm glad it's you.
Thank you, David. Thank you so much. Yeah. Yeah, and it will be different. Hopefully it becomes better because I'm repeating, right?
Well, you've got a lot of good things to say. And I think I would like to start in the same place we did yesterday. Is to talk about your store to talk about your store, explain what it is and where it is. And
yes, where? Okay. The store's name is Sattvika Bhoga. It is basically a shop for healthy grocery with some snacks in it. And the idea of the shop is, it's in Sanur, in Jalan Hang Tuah Sanur, in Bali, on the island of Bali. And the idea behind the store is that my husband Deepak and I wanted to source healthy grocery supplies for our own self. And then we thought, hey, but, you know, a lot of people also would need this healthy supply. So we decided to open the shop in 2011. Before opening the shop, we tested the waters by providing delivery service, door-to-door delivery service. And since it worked quite well, we thought, okay, now it's the time to open the shop. And we wanted mostly to connect the local producers with the local customers. That was the idea, so that we can provide a venue for the producers who wanted to produce and supply good healthy food, good quality, healthy food and grocery. Otherwise, they would find it difficult to get a market for that. And we also realized that a number of consumers wanted healthy food, so it made sense to create the shop as a bridge to both the suppliers and the consumers. Basically, that's it. We sell groceries. We sell rice, organic rice, free-range eggs, and it's lacto-ovo vegetarian, so we don't have meat in the shop. If some of our things are not organic, but we make sure that there are no preservatives, no food additives like monosodium glutamate, and no color, things like that we are quite strict with in sourcing our things. And we hope that people will eat as natural as possible. That's why we also don't have things like food supplements in capsules and things like that. We also don't have that.
Yeah.
But it's a range of goods, and David is one of our loyal customers.
Yeah.
Thank you for that, Katrinka. Yes.
thank you. Mm-hmm. Our pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes, we've been going to your store since soon after we arrived. I don't remember who told us?
How many years? I'm not so sure. 5 years, maybe?
No, almost 7 years ago.
7 years. Okay, that's good.
And you were fairly close to where we lived back then. I could walk there in about 30 minutes. And yeah, you've got dependably organic produce at a good price, and you've got whole grains and good yogurt. It's hard to get yogurt without sugar.
Yes, that's what I've been told. It's like our yogurt is homemade. There's a producer that makes it at home, so that's good.
That yeah, I really like that because I now one thing about your store is you sell, and something I want to get right away is organic non-GMO, well, non-GMO everything, but soybeans. And tell us about. That's something I learned from you is about the whole situation with soybeans in Indonesia and the history of it and what you do. And
Okay.
soy products,
Yeah,
tempeh, tofu, miso.
tofu and Well, basically, the soybean that we buy in the normal market is unidentified because we import. Indonesia imports about 70% of its soybean demand, soybean supply, and the exporters are mostly the United States, Argentina, and China. So now we know those countries do have GM soya. So what we did was, before I opened the store, I used to work with an environmental group, and one of the things that we advocated for was organic farming, organic natural farming. So we so I know of an NGO in Central Java who work with farmers in the dryland areas. And in dryland areas, normally people don't use a lot of chemicals, or even to the point that they don't use at all because it doesn't work in dryland areas. And they have local soya. Indonesian government does have nice local soya production as well, soya seeds, I mean, the mother seeds. So that this soya seeds they have been using over generations. So we thought, hey, okay, this is the right place to source soya. So we talked to them and we told them how much we need a year because soya is planted only in the dry season. It cannot take the torrential tropical rain. So we talked to them and so that's how we got our supply of soya. Then we met a producer of miso and Japanese tofu, and so we talk to them and say, if you buy the soya from us at a certain price, then you can come and bring back your goods and we will sell the miso and the tofu and the tempeh. And so that's basically what we did. And it's worked quite well. The only thing we still don't have is the soya milk because at one point there was someone who produced that, but now it has stopped. So basically that's it. So we also don't put corn in our shop unless we know that it comes from a local farmer and local seeds. Sometimes they come, sometimes they don't because of seasonal reasons. So we also don't have corn in the shop because we cannot identify where the corn comes from. So anything that we cannot identify, if we do put in the shop, we do tell our customers that we can't identify this, but some customers would like to have it, so we put it in the shop. But that's very rare. Only on some items, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't realize until you told me that pretty much all corn in Indonesia is GMO.
Corn is not so much in the eastern part of Indonesia. They still have the traditional corn in the island of Madura. Up in the mountains, they still have the old corn. But if you buy corn in the market, this is where you cannot identify, because there's a lot of corn imported as well, especially for animal feed. And animal feed and the industry to make cornmeal, to make, thickener and things like that. When you buy all this processed food, sometimes they have this thickener and into the product. So, that's basically it.
Now, you when was GMO corn soybean and corn introduced into Indonesia?
Introduced as food items, it was in the 1990s. In
And
the 1990s, yeah, but they were they're not labeled as GMO as such. Yeah, it's just that we know that the US has GM corn and GM soya, and we import some parts from the US, so
weren't wasn't Indonesia sort of forced to import it from America by because it was one of the requirements of receiving foreign aid?
In the 1970s, it's true the US provided a credit line to Indonesia, and the condition attached was to import soybeans from the US. And we do know that the US farmers are subsidized, heavily subsidized by the government of the United States. So when the soybeans came, of course, the prices were so low that the local farmers cannot compete with them. And so slowly, soybean farmers didn't want to plant soybeans because they cannot compete in the market. And Indonesians eat a lot of tofu and tempeh. So the tofu and tempeh, local producers like it when they can buy soya at a cheaper price, because that means they can sell more tofu and tempeh. So basically, that's what happened. Before that, Indonesia could supply their own 70% of the soya and corn before the credit line came. With the corn, I'm not sure what the story was. I think it began with the industrialization of animal products, of animal farms. So I didn't look into the history of that. But with soya, it was that situation in the 1970s. So also, because in the 1970s the government started the Green Revolution with rice. In the olden days, it used to be rice and then soybean or mung bean, any kind of beans that they plant in the field. And then once the dry season is over, they would again plant rice. So it's rice, beans, rice. But with the Green Revolution, the new seeds and the dams for water irrigation and everything else, it's rice. So it was forced on the farmers that it has to be rice. So there is less land for soybean as well. That's why when you look at soybean crop farming, you will see mostly are in the highlands or in the dry lands at the
And
moment. Yeah.
it's in the dry lands, because it is a crop that likes that doesn't like wet, right?
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
you were saying that I learned from you that rice used to be grown twice, two crops a year, and in between them in the dry area they'd grow soybeans, but now they almost always growing three crops a year faster because they're getting cheaper soybeans, GMO subsidized soybeans from foreign countries. Do they taste different?
Well, I think so. Some of our Japanese customers who make their own soya milk, they say that the local soya has more milk. It's creamier. And if you eat our tofu, I don't know if you've ever taken the Japanese tofu. It has a different taste from the normal tofu that is sold in the market. And I think so. I think it always tastes better.
A lot of times people who are against GMO are criticized for being anti-science. And that argument always seems to rest on whether it's good for your health or not. And I don't know about that, but my concerns about GMO have been because GMO coming in tends to destroy seed crops and diversity leads to monoculture, which is what wiped out Ireland and parts of Northern Europe with the potato famine. Is they just had monoculture, which is really makes you subject to disaster, and all the varieties of corn and soy that develop naturally with different seed stocks tend to get wiped out, and they put patents on seeds.
Patents on seeds, yeah.
And I don't know about here, but in America, GMO has gone hand in hand with destroying small farmers. And Monsanto, one of the most horrible things about Monsanto was the way any farmer that had any of their crop, their GMO crop growing there because the wind had brought it there, they'd have lawyers on them right away, and they couldn't afford to fight it, and they were just signing over farm after farm to big agribusiness. Now, that brings us to your relationship with Monsanto. Tell us about that.
Okay. Well, in the late 1990s, before that, in mid-1995 is when I began to understand the GMO issues because of our network with international NGOs at that point, including some from the US who are anti-GMOs. And I looked at it and I looked at the issue, and some of the things that you said are right. But at that time also, the issue about science was that there's a need to have precautionary principles because the GM seeds are actually not stable. That in different environment they would perform differently, and also the fact that the genes would cross over to the traditional varieties, right, as you're saying. So it was like that. The health issue was more difficult to prove, but now I think it can be proven a little bit. The issue of monoculture actually came with the Green Revolution in the 1960s and 70s. So the GM crops are actually banking on the monoculture system as well. So that's what happened. You know, the entire Green Revolution has created havoc in Indonesia in terms of rice. We lost almost 3,000 varieties of rice because of the modern dwarf irrigation sensitive and chemical sensitive rice seeds
Wow.
developed. So that is so monoculture actually began in the in those days. Monoculture in tree crops, of course, began with the colonial system, but that's another story. So now on Monsanto. Well, when we started that, so we started a campaign, an education program to tell people that this is coming. Of course, that time we didn't have any GMO seeds yet. Then in late 1990s, we got information that Monsanto, through its subsidiary in Indonesia, wanted to import GM cotton seeds to be planted in Sulawesi. So we told our Ministry of Agriculture that, you know, you have to be careful that this must be this must go through rigorous testing and everything else. And they said, oh yeah, we did the field testing and everything. And finally, they approved the planting of the seeds. So we sued them in the administrative court, the Ministry of Agriculture. We were actually suing the Ministry of Agriculture for legalizing the GM cotton seeds to be planted in Sulawesi. That was the issue. Then Monsanto came and told the judge, they asked the judge, they requested the judge to also put them as a defendant. So we ended up suing both Monsanto and the Ministry of Agriculture. The reason was that they said they had a stake in the proceeding, in the legal proceedings, and therefore they would like to be part of it. And that's how we, ended up suing Monsanto as well, the subsidiary in Indonesia, not the Monsanto in the US. So we lost the case, but we had a lot of publicity and people were starting to ask what is GM and why should we be careful, and a lot of questions were being asked, and the seeds were finally planted. But after 3 years, they had a 3 years contract, I think, the government. I think they just could not sustain it, so the whole project was scraped. And up
That's
to
so
today,
great. And why was it scraped? I mean, because when there's big money and a big corporation like that behind it, I mean, why did the government do that?
no, it wasn't the government. It Monsanto decided not to continue with the project when the contract term was terminated, ended. You see,
Oh.
the contract, it was for 3 years, I think.
Why did they decide not to, just wasn't working well?
I think it wasn't working well. They promised that the cotton would be strong enough to against the bollworm, against the bollworm. That's what the BT, it was a BT cotton, Bacillus thuringiensis cotton, and they said that it would, that the less pest would come, and it didn't happen that way, and farmers were disappointed, and I think they had to pay a lot of administrative money or something to the local government and the central government. And then, of course, there was already a big campaign by that time. So I think they finally, and the yield wasn't as they promised. I think that was the final catch. The yield was not as high as they had promised. That's the thing. So I guess their expenses sort of went up. And in any case, my guess is that BT cotton is not a very important crop now in Indonesia. we import a lot of our cotton for the textiles factory.
Oh.
I think it was an entry point to go into corn and soya, because that's where the big market is. So I think they script it. And I am glad now, because when people come to my store, it's not just the Westerners, even the locals would ask me, are the soya GM soya? So I think over the years people understand what they would like to eat and what they're eating.
So you do have non-GMO organic soybeans, tofu, tempeh, and miso. Yeah, that's good. And I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, but my experience, I've made soy milk, and that when I buy the beans, it's almost entirely for soy milk. We make our own almond cashew milk, and that's mainly what we like, but sometimes we make some soy milk, and it just doesn't last long. I mean, if it's not, commercial and whatever they do to put it in packaging and bottles so that it lasts. We don't do that. So it has to arrive, it has to be kept cool and arrive and be sold within a couple of days, right?
True. I think it is true with all plant-based milk as well. I mean, sorry, Dave. And it's true with the normal milk as well, if you don't pasteurize it.
That's true. That's
Yeah.
true.
So, natural foods don't last as long as the packaging says,
Right,
right?
right. I used to sell raw milk in a little store the San Francisco Zen Center had. I used to sell raw milk there, and it worked out all right. I've always been more concerned about homogenization than pasteurization. But anyway, I use a little whole milk in my tea, just a little bit to add to the to give it a little body, but I don't really dig in much of it. Well, let's see. Let's see. Is there another food-based question? Well, oh no, let me go back to your taking on your being involved with environmentalism. You were in you're from Jakarta. No, well, you grew up in Jakarta.
Yeah, I grew
It,
up in Jakarta.
you and Deepak both.
Yeah,
And
we both.
you so how did you get involved with environmentalism there?
Well, I studied biology in the university. And why did I choose biologists? Because I somehow was always fascinated with plants. I used to experiment planting bean seeds and onions and things like that. And I thought, okay, if I want to know a little bit more, then I better study biology and major in botany. And so that's what I did. And then I knew several people who used to work with who worked with the environmental NGOs, and so I became a volunteer in one of those NGOs, and that's how I got involved. I mean, it was a natural thing. It just came. I mean, like, I didn't look for it. It was just in front. It passes through my life, and I just it felt right. So I just took it on. That's it. It wasn't a dramatic thing. It was just like it just comes in front. It came in front, and I just took it. That's it.
Now, are the what are the environmental organizations in Indonesia, are they very strong?
I And they started in the 1980s. I think they were really strong during the year between 1990s and 2010, at the national level. But now we see a growing number of local NGOs who are quite strong. Like in Bali, you see the blending of the NGOs and the Desa Adat, yeah, the traditional villages against the Benoa Bay reclamation, if you've heard of it. Yeah, so that's a yeah. So at local on local and localized issues are quite strong, but at the national level, we still face a lot of policy issues and I mean it's up and downs. Now I think a lot more people are interested in social and political issues. So that's what we're looking at. Yeah.
Well, what do you think
Nice.
about the law that was just passed to weaken workers' rights in environmental regulations and things like that to encourage foreign investment?
I have to confess I didn't follow that new law, so I don't really know what's in it. There are two different opinions in going around. I do believe that the law has to be that the many different laws need to be put together, but how strong or how weak those things are, I cannot say at the moment. I have not really looked at it.
Right, it just happened, and the way it looks to me is it's not really a law yet. And that the last time they tried something like this, they ended up canceling it. So we'll see. Of course, we know the burning of forests and where Kalimantan and place like that is major destruction to Indonesian natural resources. I remember seeing the general in charge of protecting the forest interviewed. He said, "Well, it's progress." He called it progress.
We do have officials like that sometimes.
I haven't heard so much about it in the last couple of years, but there was major air pollution and smoke in the air, especially not here from it because we're too far away, but it was going up into Malaysia and Singapore, and Singapore sued Indonesia, and then my Malaysian environmentalist engaged Buddhist friend said that most of the major investors are from Singapore and Malaysia.
Yes, true. Yeah, true. It's like it's the cross border intercross border air pollution because the forests are nearer to Singapore and Malaysia, right? And I think the current government has somehow curbed a little of that, at least almost half of it. We haven't heard of of that happening as much as before, yeah.
I know that's really true. I hope that's true. I know they're very well aware of it. Jokowi has to. He has to balance all the pressures on him, which are enormous. Now, one thing I have noticed through the years is that really active environmentalists at the local level in important places where there's where forests are being, or jungles are being destroyed, or mines, have oftentimes disappeared. are been found dead. So have you noticed that?
Yeah, not often, but in several places. I think I don't know what really happened because I'm not there, but in many cases it's a collusion between the local law and the owners of the factories and the companies, maybe. I don't know.
Why don't you tell us about like where your parents and where Deepak's parents came from and that whole history of why your family is here and what your what your ethnic background is.
You really want to hear about that history?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love it. I think it's really interesting.
Okay. Well, we are Sindhis. Our parents came from Sindh. S-I-N-D. Sindh is now a province in Pakistan. Okay?
Yeah.
It is a province in Pakistan. Yeah?
Yeah.
And but before Pakistan was created in 1947, it was part of India. The whole country was part of India. And it was under the British rule for many years. So when India, the Indian people demanded independence, as usual, the British, of course, created a rift between the Hindus and the Muslims. And so the Muslims ended up saying that they also need a separate state. And that's how the India-Pakistan partition happened. So Sindh was given to Pakistan, the entire province. And my parents were Hindus. So there was often during the partition process, the Hindu Muslims, the Hindu Sindhis and the Muslim Sindhis were very good friends. They are family. They have no problem. They had no problem with that. It was the refugees coming in from India that created the problem. And so
the Muslim refugees coming in from India to be part of Pakistan, the new state after partition.
After partition. So they decided that it's not a safe place to stay in. They then traveled to cross the border to India became refugees in Jodhpur. And then from Jodhpur, they were transferred to a refugee camp in Kalyan, in Mumbai, near Mumbai. So, but my father had already started working in Indonesia in 1925 or 1930s, something like that. So he actually came back home after the World War II to see his family because he was alone in with his two brothers. They went back to see their family when the partition happened. So that's when he decided that after being refugees for about 6 months or a year, I think it was, something like that, they decided, my father decided that, you know, we can't continue living like this in India because a lot of refugees were there. The government had to provide a lot of jobs and everything, right?
Yeah.
So they decided that they would migrate to Indonesia. And that was to a small city in East Java, Jombang. And so that's where I was born. Deepak's family moved to migrated to Situbondo, also in East Java. That's where he was born. And then when we were growing up, I was about 7 or 8 years old when we decided to move to Jakarta. The family decided to move to Jakarta, so that's how I grew up in Jakarta. Deepak's family came a bit later, so. So I met Deepak in Jakarta when we were both already grown up.
And
So
when did you
that's the
meet
history.
Deepak?
I met Deepak in 1989 or 1990, I think. Yeah, 1990. Early 1990, and we got married 1990 in December. So we've been married for 30 years now.
And wasn't your marriage encouraged by the families?
Well, we were introduced by the families because we were both busy with our work and decide, didn't want to get involved. So they decided they thought, this two would like sort of hit it off. So let them introduce in. So they just arranged it in a very subtle way. Yeah. And it worked. And it worked.
And it's worked out very well. So you got married in 1990, 30 years ago. Good for you. And how old were you then?
27.
27. That's neat. That's neat. And what
Yeah,
was
so
Deepak, what was he doing back then?
Deepak studied mechanical engineering. So he's very interested in all this electrical mechanical things, and he was working with computers at that time. So he was he's got different kinds of interests, but his last interest was as a sales person for new computer programming technologies. That's what he's interested in. So he's the mechanical side of the family, of the partnership, and
And
I'm the environment social side of the partnership.
why did you come to Bali? And when?
We came to Bali in 2003, but before that, Deepak had a partnership for a computer training program company in 2001, and we decided that we don't want to live in Jakarta. It was so congested in traffic jam and everything. So we decided to just move to Bali. Like
Well,
that's how it happened.
Bali has a reputation in Indonesia very much like it has in the world, doesn't it? It's,
Yeah, sure.
I mean, it's the favorite vacation place for Indonesians. There's more Indonesian tourists here than anything, I think.
True.
Not now.
Not now, but no, a lot of Indonesian people, when they hear Bali, oh, one day I want to go there. No, it's true. It has a different character. That's right.
Well, was the fact that it was Hindu make you want to come here?
Not in the first place, but of course, when we started living here, we felt more comfortable. That's true. But no, I think the choice was that it's a smaller place. It's a more relaxed place, and everything is easy, and it's just something different that we knew we didn't want to live all our lives in a big city like Jakarta. So this was like it came through our it came into our life, and we just decided, okay, this is the place we want to stay at the moment. So that's what we did.
So you moved here, and Deepak was involved with a company.
Yeah, a computer training company until 2004 or 2005, I think.
Oh, really?
And yeah, and then after that, the company decided to shift close down, and we continued living in Bali.
And what did both of you do then? I mean, what were you doing and what was he doing?
Deepak works as a we both were consultants on different areas. So he was a consultant on networking systems of the computer and all that. And I continued with my environmental work from home. So got involved in new issues like climate change and you know, intellectual property rights overseas, things like that. So that's how we...
Oh, intellectual property rights. Indonesia's a little behind the world on that. And, you know, I never pay for any software on my computer. I don't even know how you would.
Yeah, no, but our concern was more on the seeds issue, like seeds should not be patented. And and regulations on generic medicine, why should, you know, that the owner of patents should allow generic medicine, especially when it comes to a public health crisis like now. So that was my main concern.
And when did you get your home, the one where we've been?
I lived in Batu Bulan, right? That was since we built it ourselves slowly since 2005. Yeah, I think we started living here in 2006, early 2006.
And I can see now Deepak's engineering electrical background because.
Yeah.
You have a gray water system.
Yes.
Which, does anyone else have a gray water system here?
Well, the hotels were supposed to have that. There is a local regulation that the new hotels being built must have a gray water system.
That's
how we learned. We actually learned from a friend who worked in the environmental office, provincial environmental office. And this the system that Deepak has helped to put in together is called the Bali Wastewater System. So it wasn't a new system. He just adapted that and make sure that when we were building the house that we had that. So we don't have a gutter in front of our house because we don't have any wastewater to throw. Because we clean up our wastewater. There's a system where the plants eat up all the toxic, and the water is put back on the earth, like that.
And you have a biofuel system.
Yes.
Tell about that.
It's a simple composting system. We use kitchen scrap. So we use all the vegetable peel, you know, when we sometimes have bad potatoes or overripe bananas that cannot be eaten, all these things go into the, we put water on it and, you know, wait for about 2 days until they all get very soft and then put it in a tank, a dual system tank, and we get methane cooking gas to cook our meals.
That's so great.
That's so great.
And you're still planning to do
solar. Yeah, sorry.
But
solar, sorry.
That's harder to do you use any air conditioning?
Only in two rooms, but not used like every day. So one is in the guest bedroom. So when the guests come, I mean, in our room, we have a ventilation system, so I don't need that. And one is in the audio video room. That's when people gather and watch movies. That's the only two air conditionings that I have. Because the house is built to maximize air circulation, so we hardly use any.
Right.
And cooler,
Far superior. Oh boy, I don't like living in air conditioning.
I know.
We sleep with air conditioning because Katrinka likes sleeping, and that's all right. And it keeps all our clothes dry and everything. But that's the only time we use it, except in my my studio for recording. It's our small guest bedroom, and it's completely closed. And I have an air conditioner going on a very high temperature, just so it doesn't get stuffy. that's the only time I use it. When she's in America, I never turn it on at all. And when I was a kid, when I was 12 years old, we moved from our home where we had ceiling fans and what is called an attic fan, which would just bring wind in from every window and suck it up into the attic. And then we moved to a new home that had central air conditioning. And I was 12 years old, and I told Mother I did not want air conditioning in my room. I shut the vent. She had a ceiling fan put in there, and I kept the windows open.
Okay, that's good. Yeah.
But we, you know, we kept the house open anytime. It gets very hot where I come from in Texas, hotter than here. But when it wasn't the hot season or the super cold season, we'd have the house open. You know, one thing about the Hinduism here, you and Deepa are, your type of Hinduism is like my type of Hinduism. It's Advaita Vedanta. He pronounced it Advaita. Advaita Vedanta.
Advaita.
Can you explain what Advaita Vedanta is? Do you say Vedanta?
We can say Vedanta. We can say Advaita, Dharma. I mean, Vedanta is like based on the Vedas, right? But basically, it's the Advaita philosophy, actually.
And what is it?
It's Dvaita means dualism. Advaita means non-dualism.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's like this. The way we look at it from the readings and from some of the lectures that we hear on it. You see, there are three ways of looking at religion, God, or whatever you want to say the supreme energy is. One is when you look at a God or the supreme energy as a parent, as a protector, as somebody who decides everything. And that's, you know, so you create fear, like if you don't do anything right, that that person or that energy will punish you, and you know, something which is so far away from us. So that's one way of looking at it. And the second way is when you look at the supreme energy as your friend, as somebody who you know quite well, you know, like your friend, your lover, your you know, somebody that you feel comfortable with, that you would like to serve. That's the bhakti, the serving part of it. And then look at the supreme being as part of yourself, or you as part of the supreme being, and that's Advaita, because there's no separation. Advaita is basically that. There's no separation.
Yeah.
And when you look at quantum physics, this is actually very scientific, because quantum physics say that a chair is a chair because we label it as a chair, but the chair can actually be used for a million possibility other things, right?
Yeah,
it's because we start labeling the chair as a chair on which we sit that we we limit the chair's function only as a place that where we sit, whereas it can actually have a lot of other potentials.
Yeah.
So basically, that's what Advaita is. So it looks at all humanity, all life as part of the entire universe.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, that's. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Oh no! Perfect. Perfect.
Yeah.
I call it right Zen Hinduism.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's very much like the Buddhism that I know, and and you know the local people, their Hinduism is so infused with animism with spirits,
okay.
And it's shamanic, and so most of the activity I see with Hinduism here with local people is animistic, is around spirits and making offerings to spirit. I like it. And I go to the, what do you call that ceremony where you get purified? Maluka?
Maluka, yeah, Maluka.
Maluka. Yeah, I do those. And I wear the three color.
The
Tridatu.
The Tridatu, yes.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
And whenever I tell local people, you know, Hindus, that I'm a Buddhist, they say, "Oh, same as Hinduism." And of course,
yes.
Balinese Hinduism does have a lot of Buddhism in its, maybe not in its practice, but in its historical basis. And because Bali was Buddhist long ago. I appreciate the Vaitwadatta, and as you know, I spent time living near the Ramana Ashram in Tiruvannamalai, India, in Tamil Nadu. When I first met you all, I thought it was really cool that you were you were descended from Pakistani Hindus, and that you had taken on Monsanto.
Thank you.
Yeah, I thought, wow, that is neat. I wanted to just ask you about three things. One is trash, especially plastic trash. The second is pollution, like with pesticides and air pollution. And the third is global warming. Now, I know these are all things you're involved with. You were thinking of it when you first opened your store, for instance. And from the very first, your store opened in 2003?
2010.
10. Oh, right.
So
you moved here in 2003.
Yeah. 2011, we opened the store. Sorry.
Yeah. And so what were you had a policy about plastic bags then?
Yeah.
And what was it?
Okay. So when we opened the store, we decided that we didn't want to provide free plastic bags. So we actually put a very high price for plastic bag, but we put a notice in front. So when we opened the store, we didn't have too many customers, so we could identify. Then we, you know, if the customer say, "Oh, I didn't know," and I said, "Okay, this time we will allow you to have one plastic bag, but the next time you come, do please bring your own bag." That's what we used to do. And we can't get rid of all plastic packagings. That would be a
No.
little bit impossible. But we decided that some items can be bought bulk. So people can bring their own containers for rice and the local beans, you know. And
Yeah.
we did not package the salad, so people can actually take one and then put in their bag like that. That's how we did it. And the most difficult part was actually the plastic bag, because people got so much used to having so many plastic bags from supermarkets, you know. And they
Yeah.
said, why? And we had to stand there all the time. Either Deepak or I have to be there to explain to people why we're doing it. Some people understood. The next time they come, they came, they actually brought a bag. And those people who think that, you know, well, we will just buy. I mean, I was charging 4,000 rupiah per bag. That's a lot of money, okay? Because you know, but we tried not to sell the plastic bags, so we provided used boxes and used other you know, sacks or bags or whatever. And so slowly people began to understand. So those who understand, they will come and bring their own bag. They would come and bring their own bag. But
Yeah.
you know, towards the end, before there was a regulation, towards the end, we had like 60% of our consumers actually brought their own bag. So it took a long time, and Deepak and I had to be, because the staff sometimes cannot explain, or if they explain, people wouldn't listen. So we had to be there to help out. At least during the first 1 or 2 years, it was quite difficult.
Wow,
And
you're
then,
pioneers.
yeah. So, and then 2 years ago, I think, is it 2018 or 2017? I think it was 2018. The Denpasar local government published a regulation saying that there should be no all supermarkets should not provide plastic bags. And that was like the breakthrough that we were waiting for so many years, because now we just printed out a poster about that and put it in the door of our store and say, look, now we are abiding by the law, rather than creating our own reasons why we didn't want. So now we have a lot of people who, you know, most of our customers bring their own bag. And
Yeah.
and some even bring their own containers for rice and eggs and beans that we put on bulk. So it's a slow process, but it's coming up. And then of course
Yeah.
the governor also, the Bali governor, then decided to follow. And I think now it's almost in the entire Bali that supermarkets are not allowed to give plastic bags. How the law is being implemented is another issue.
Oh,
And
yes.
we're just talking about one issue, which is the plastic bag. And no one has done a research yet whether the plastic bags are this plastic bag regulation has created a reduction in the plastic bag trash. That's something that we need to also look at.
Yeah.
It's just one aspect of the plastic trash, because the modern way of living is now a packaging system. I mean, all your food, all your water, your medicine, they all come in plastic packaging. In the olden days, when you visit a house of a family, they would say, would you like to drink a drink of water? And they would have a kettle, and you take a glass and give you water in a glass. Or they might have a bottle of cold water in the refrigerator, and a glass bottle that they had filled with the water, and they give you that water. But now you will see in many places they have actually, the plastic water, the plastic glass water. You have seen that?
Oh, yeah.
Most of the well-to-do families would have that, and then they say, "Oh, you want water?" And that's what they put in front of you.
Yeah,
And
we
it's
make our own, we filter our own water
yeah.
and
So when
never
the yeah.
buy those things.
That's right. So I always bring my water bottle, and so when they say, "Would you like to drink water?" I said, "No, I have my own water bottle. I don't want to use that water."
I
So
know.
it's everywhere, it's like that, even in restaurants. So I think regulations are needed on that, and also awareness. And all this thing came from the industry, and the industry was encouraged by it's part of the so-called development process, which is not really right.
That's
And
right.
because a lot of our water has been polluted, now this is where the connection comes. People are afraid to drink tap water because it's not healthy. I mean, in the olden days, I used to drink water off the tap. It's fine. And then when I moved to Jakarta, we had to boil our water. Because in the big cities, you don't drink water off the tap because the government doesn't provide those services. And now, of course, a lot of the water sources are taken over by the water industry. So everything industrialized. So, I agree that bottled water do come in handy in certain cases in our life, like when we are in the airport. But even the airports in Europe provide water for drinking. It's the airports in developing countries that don't do that for some reason that I cannot understand why. So this whole thing about that's a thing. And then now we have the ordering food, ordering food from the restaurant that are being brought by the delivery person, whether it's Gojek, Grab, or any other online. That is also a lot of plastic, right?
Yeah, but there's been a lot of sort of paper packaging used for food, maybe that's treated with wax or something on the inside. We don't see I mean, I can think of one place near here that uses the styrofoam still, but we don't see much of that.
Now we don't see a lot. That's
Yeah,
true.
but look at the places we order from, they're very nice places with good food. I mean, they're not the they're not the general usual places. So I'm not sure. It seems to me that plastic packaging, not just to get it in a store when you buy, but plastic packaging is so universal that that we have to. And there is biodegradable plastic has been developed. Some of it not that biodegradable, take forever. But I think we have to focus on making plastic packaging out of organic materials that can biodegrade, because it's just so hard for people to change.
I agree with you. I mean, it's not I'm not saying that all plastic should be banned. It's the one-time use plastics. And
Oh,
if we
yeah.
do, if we do use one-time plastics, then there must be regulations proper about how do we dispose of it, and how does the government then reprocess that plastic or
Yeah.
discharge it. And that's what's lacking in many countries, both developed and developing. Because in the developed countries, what they do is they take all the plastics and then just dump it in developing countries as an import subsidy or whatever. Or they say we will open a plastic recycling company in your country, and therefore you take our trash and do it here, or incineration, or all sorts of those funny things where people are not being honest about what they do with the plastic. So I think that it's a global responsibility, just like
It's
the
a,
global warming.
yeah, it's a global problem, and also the global recycling system has broken down. It's a major problem in the in Europe and in America. China is an enormous producer of trash going into the oceans. And Indonesia is second behind China, but way behind. And yeah, I mean the trash global trash problem is enormous.
And it's
And
difficult,
but the and then you have the problem with pesticides and different types of poisons entering into the system. But I think that the climate change is a much greater problem. What do you think about that?
Climate change is, yes, it's an issue, it's a global issue, but I would think it's easier to tackle if, again, if developed countries are serious about it, because it's mostly caused by the lifestyle and the industrialization. See, what's happening is like this. Europe has kept its air clean, all right? So, but what does it do? I mean, even in the US and Japanese. So what do they do? They then impose that dirty technologies into developing countries. Now that has to stop. Any kind of technology for manufacturing technology, transportation technology, any kind of technology that are being developed in developing countries that are clean must be transferred to developing countries. I mean,
Yeah,
banned.
with financial assistance.
Yes, with financial assistance. And going that together with that is there are two things. One is educating the public, which is our job as citizens of Indonesia, that we need to do that, and we are doing it, and a lot of effort are being done, maybe not by the government, but by the citizens, if you see a lot of things are being developed. And the other thing is to curb the corruption. And curbing the corruption, okay, we also do that because that's our responsibility. But the cooperation, the funding from developed countries must also look into this corruption system. Sometimes they go hand in hand, I think we can do a lot at the individual level, but at the global level, we need to understand, we need to tell the citizens of developed countries about how their government and the corporations behave in our countries. I think that's important because only they can change their, I can't tell the US government what to do, right?
No.
You
Well,
can
you
tell
can
them what to
try.
do. Exactly, right? It's just as we say, we can tell our governments what to do. I mean, we have had a lot of problems with the governments as well. But things are slowly changing in Indonesia, no? And as I said, we have laws against the plastic bags now, and things are beginning to look up. And I think this is where the Advaita that you were talking about comes in handy, the philosophy that we all are one family. We only have one earth, and therefore we all need to do what we need to do for each other.
Well said. Well said. Well, I appreciate your spending so much time with me talking about all this. Do you have...
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it is. It's my pleasure. I've run out of questions. I think you've done a wonderful job. Is there, I mean, what better ending than saying we're all one family? When...
Exactly. We have a Sanskrit word for that. Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam. The universe, yes, the whole universe is a family. So that includes the COVID virus, okay?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
Well, I'm happy to be part of your family. And
we are happy that you're part of our family as well.
And thanks a lot, and I appreciate it.
And thank you for...
And oh, your book. Wait, we didn't mention your book.
Okay. Yeah, that's about the Sindhis, yeah?
Yeah, you got to tell about the book, because you just...
I just finished writing a book, which is now in the printing press, about the history of how the Hindu Sindhis came to Indonesia. It's based on interview with the elderly, with some elderly people who actually experienced the migration from Sindh to India and then India to Indonesia. The book is called The Landless Winners. So the Sindhis left their land, the Hindu Sindhis left their land. They don't have a heritage land, but they have become economic winners wherever they go, including in Indonesia. They have adopted Indonesia as their motherland and survived being a refugee because, you know, and without international support, without funding, without asking people for money, they actually did it on their own. And so that's what the book is about.
Yeah.
And it will be published soon, and I will make sure that you get a copy.
And I want you to make an ebook, because it's
yes,
in English.
Yeah, it's in English. It's in English because the reason why I did that was because I wanted the younger generation, the young people, the young Sindhi people, to understand their history. That's why I
No, I understand.
Because many of my other books are written in Indonesian.
What are your other books? Tell us about them.
I have a book on World Trade Organization, and then I have a book, a collection of my articles in newspapers before, and then I have a book on the food system in Indonesia. And then I wrote a small book on intellectual property rights and access to medicine. And a number of other things. They're all in my blog. It's called bebaspikir.com, which I will send you a link.
Yeah, that's good. That'd be good. And all those books, though, are in Indonesian, right?
Yeah, most of them. I do have other papers in English. The blog is both English and Indonesian, so some of the things are in English.
I really wasn't aware of that, so I'm glad to know that. So I've got some homework to do there.
Okay.
Yeah. You're very modest. You know, if it was me, I'd be telling you all about it. Wow, that's really neat. Okay. Well, you know what? I've got to go pay for another year's rent, so that's going to take me a couple of hours. You know, I get the money by making ATM withdrawals. No bank transfers or anything. It's too expensive.
No,
it saves. It can save me hundreds of dollars cheaper. to get it. Oh,
Oh,
yeah, to
really?
get it out of
Oh, okay.
ATM. So I the fir
Ah.
when we first moved here, I paid, you know, we have wonderful, wonderful landlord and very reasonable rent. We paid $120 million for 2 years here. You can't get a house like ours in this area. He likes us because we meditate and do yoga, and he does too. And he has not increased. This is my our second rent extension, and he doesn't increase the rent. Of course, we have put so
Okay,
much
that's
into this house, thousands of millions and millions of rupiah. But a lot of landlords
okay, that's
charge you
great.
for it, then double your rent when you do that.
Yeah, when you do that, because they think you like it, so you know that you wouldn't leave. No, I agree. No, in Sanur, I found it like that. It's the same way with the rent in our shop. They increase, but reasonable inflation increase, you know? Yeah. So, yeah, I think it's better. It's not like Ubud or Canggu where they actually go beyond beyond reasonability.
Well, sometimes I know individual cases here where there have been unreasonable rent increases that made people leave. Even
That's true.
and sometimes that were very foolish on the part of the landlord because you know, there's so many empty places, not homes like this, or and also your store location is excellent. I mean for us anyway. Okay, well, thanks for all that. That's good. That's good.
Thank
And
you.
I will we will be in touch soon. I
Yeah,
was
sure. Okay.
okay.
And drink a hug for me.
And send Deepak my regards and tell him I really appreciate
Sure.
his wife.
Okay. Well, the next time you see him, you tell him that
Okay, yeah, I
yourself.
will. I will. He knows. He knows I
Thank you,
appreciate both of
David.
you. We both do. Okay,
Okay.
thanks a lot.
Yes,
Take
all
care.
right. Yeah, take care. Have a
You
nice
too. Bye
day.
bye.
Bye.
So thank you very much, Hira Jamtani, J-H-A-M-T-A-N-I, J-H, interesting, huh? Yeah, that was great, really appreciate it. And so we're going to sign off here. If you enjoyed life in Bali, we'd appreciate it if you'd like to help us keep going. If you go to the homepage of Qk.com, and you'll see a little donate button up there, and down below there's another one. You click on it. There's one on the Qk Audio Podbean homepage too. You go to the donate page, shows you how to send a check or make a PayPal donation or become a PayPal subscriber for as little as $1 a month. We'd really appreciate it. And it's easy to do and a very refreshing, fun experience. So until next time, this is DC, Poobah of Qk Audio and Qk Archives, coming to you from sleepy Sanur with Dogget Bandita, Feline Kuchita, and dear lovely Katrinka, and wishing you and yours and all of us a grand awakening.